This is an ABC podcast.
Corbin and Ben, Monday and Thursday, 5 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. And catch up anytime in the podcast store under the Best of Grandstand folder. Or check us out on the website, abc.net.au/grandstand. However you're listening, as long as you are, we're happy about that. My name's Corbin Middlemass on the east coast of Australia. Out west is Ben Cameron. Hello, Ben.
The number of people who continue to download it in the podcast store under the Best of Grandstand continues to rise like a gold medal tally at the Olympics. Corbin, now I've got a bone to pick with you right off the top. I'm coming in hot. I'm just deciding still whether I forgive you for your message to me during the 100-metre freestyle final. I was streaming it online, and I got a message from you right as Kyle Chalmers was diving off the starting blocks, which read, "Bugger, I thought he'd got him there at the end." And he completely ruined the exciting finish to the race for me and my viewing pleasure.
You're paraphrasing there, by the way, as well.
It didn't say bugger, I think it's safe to say.
You know the rules, Ben. If you're not watching live, it's no phones. That's sort of well established by now. It's like people that complain about hearing the score if there's a delayed telecast on the TV. But the bigger question is, how come you weren't watching in front of a normal television? Why are you watching on catch up through some sort of streaming service?
Well, I had myself well set up in the study, Corbin. I was multitasking, preparing for Corbin and Ben, being the diligent broadcaster I am.
The day before, it's been raining in Melbourne all day on Wednesday. I went for a little trot and I was like, this is great. I've got a day off all by myself. No one's going to annoy me. Put the TV on pause, came back, and you told me that we'd won 4 gold medals, which was actually inaccurate. We'd won 3. So then I'm sitting down to watch a replay of the races thinking we're going to win every race because I know that we're going to get to 4, and it turns out 2 of them had happened in the rowing. But we only won 3, so there was one other. I was thinking, what a poor experience to enjoy the swimming. But it had been completely ruined because you'd messaged me saying, we won 4 gold this morning.
The best part is I got about 3 texts later in the day saying, where was the 4th gold medal?
I never saw it. Trying to get
to the bottom of it.
And never saw it. Never ended up happening. We're one of those cheesy radio show hosts. We've got a big show today. Absolutely, we have a big show today. Shani Norder is going to join us, formerly Shani Layton. Now, in the peak of Shani's career, Ben, when she was one of the best defenders in world netball, she had her own battles with mental health and as a result withdrew herself from professional netball. After a little bit of time out, she decided she wants to go and play footy for a bit more enjoyment. So we're going to chat with Shani today about the Simone Biles situation, which has really had the whole world talking over the last couple of days. Ben, on Tuesday night, I remember when it came through, I was sort of lying in bed, I was watching, flicking through every single news outlet in the US trying to get some kind of reaction to it. I ended up flicking on CNN and watching their reports on the story. I couldn't get enough of the Simone Biles situation. So we'll talk to Shani Norder about that. And there's a new series coming to the ABC, Ben, through iView this Sunday morning from 7 a.m. called Strong Women, which is about the sport of strongman. Do you know much about strongman?
Only what I've seen very superficially on broadcasts on the TV of the men sort of hurling these heavy bricks over walls and picking up boulders and dragging trucks, etc. That's all I know about it. Very surface level, if you will.
And we're going to find out a bit more about it. So this ABC docuseries follows 4 Australian strongwomen, including Lee Holland Keane, who's going to be our guest on Corbin and Ben today. So that'll be a nice little tease to get you into Strong Women, which is released on iView this coming Sunday. This is Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport. We are predominantly an Aussie rules show, so we better do some footy off the top, Ben, before we look a little more broad with the Olympics and Strong Women docuseries. The Carlton Review, flesh it out, throw it out.
Flesh it out, Corbin. Let's flesh this out. It's been the biggest talking point right throughout, and I know you have some really strong opinions about it. The report, the recommendations have been handed in by Luke Sayers, who's been doing the report, the incoming Carlton chairman or president, He's handed in his recommendations, but there are 4 weeks remaining in the season. What can they get out of that 4 weeks, Corbin?
I have no idea. I don't know what to feel. I'm calling this game tomorrow night, Ben, and as we sit here right now, I have no idea what to feel about tomorrow night. So if Carlton win, is it this uplifting moment? If they lose, does the situation get worse, or is it already at its worst point for David Teague? Does the result even matter tomorrow night for what happens with Carlton? It's so confusing. And then after the game against St Kilda, they have matches against Gold Coast, Port Adelaide and GWS. The stupid thing about all this, Ben, had they beaten North Melbourne, who were the worst team on the ladder, that'd be 2 points out of the top eight. They beat St Kilda on Friday night, they're in the eight. And all of a sudden the review's done, and you sort of think, what sort of role does that loss to North Melbourne on the weekend, is that going to be the critical point in time that we look back on it, Ben, and we think, oh, yeah, it was the loss to North Melbourne on that Saturday afternoon, which ultimately cost David Teague his job. I feel like it's a long time to try and ride out and ultimately to try and silence some of this noise. You think about if they've handed in the recommendations, Ben, there's going to be every single journalist in town trying to work out exactly what's in it and what it means before we get to round 23. A month's a long time in footy.
Now, Luke Sayers is an incredible businessman, Corbin, and has achieved more in business than I'm ever likely to. But how many mulligans does this current Carlton board get for appointing coaches? So
point.
Luke Sayers has been there 7 years, Corbin.
Yep.
So by my reckoning, he's lived through the Mick Malthouse saga.
Yep.
They've appointed Brendan Bolton.
Yes.
They've sacked Brendan Bolton and appointed David Teague.
Yep.
So if the recommendation comes back that David Teague is not the right man, mm-hmm. how many mulligans do they get?
That's a great point. Yeah, I think time's just about up. I would argue the Teague appointment was almost the fans. The board was left with no choice. But ultimately, they're the ones that are...
It was player power and the fans, wasn't it?
Yeah, but they're the ones that are culpable for it. Collingwood's next captain, flesh it out, throw it out.
Flesh it out. I know you made some comments about this over the course of the weekend on your program. Who's more likely to remain captain of their club next year? Is it Trent Cotchin? Is it Scott Pendlebury? Interesting to note today, as reported by our friend and friend of Corbin and Ben, Mitch Cleary today, Collingwood are going to rotate the captaincy for the remainder of the year without Scott Pendlebury. So it will start with Steele Sidebottom. It'll be Taylor Adams. And it will also be, who's the
Jeremy
fourth
Howe?
Member? Jeremy Howe. So the question is, who is most likely to lead Collingwood next year? I think the obvious choice at this point in time is going to be Taylor Adams as the next captain of the Collingwood Football Club. If they make a move from Scott Pendlebury, which may well be the case, given that there is an alignment there with a fresh start, a new coach. Nathan Buckley has left. He's been the captain for a long period of time. He's not getting any younger. Maybe it is time for a fresh start with Taylor Adams as the captain of Collingwood.
I think the other two in the conversation would be Darcy Moore, who's been in a leadership group previously, and Braden Maynard, popular member of the team. So they would probably be the candidates. I think you could make the case, though, that Scott Pendlebury, as someone who's been there in a stable figure, is perhaps the option next year, given that there's been so much change elsewhere. We could potentially have more changes at board level. You know,
that's the
senior
inverse,
coach
isn't
changes.
It?
Yeah, maybe they go with some kind of stability on that front. Answer that question for me, though. Pendlebury or Cotchin, who's most likely to captain next year? There's almost this feeling, you put your finger in the wind, that there will be change at both clubs in the captaincy position.
Most likely to still be captain next year.
Yep.
I think most likely is Trent Cotchin.
I think too.
Because there's a dearth of options at Richmond.
Well, seemingly, yeah.
Seemingly.
I said on the weekend, I thought maybe we could have a year with Jack Graham and Trent Cotchin, but it doesn't look like that's going to be the case. Brett Delidio telling us on the weekend, Damien Hardwick, not a big fan of the co-captain model. The boxing ban that the AFL has placed on teams, flesh it out, throw it out?
Yeah, flesh it out. I heard Luke Beveridge speaking about this today, Corbin. Roll the tape.
The AFL should never be in the business of telling clubs how they can train and how they can't train. So it's really important that the messages out of AFL House aren't too directive and too arbitrary around what you can and can't do. Our boxing coach Johnny does a magnificent job with our players one on one. There's a lot of sparring with mitts and just because one club gets it wrong from a risk management point of view, doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that every other club all of a sudden becomes vulnerable and needs to eliminate the risk. So we'll continue boxing with Johnny, and it's a really important part of our program, an important conditioning aspect of what we do. We don't spar player to player, but we haven't been told what we can and can't do until we get something formal. Then we won't even really take much notice. And but we'll definitely be continuing on with what we do with our boxing coach, and who does a great job with us.
Didn't really cut that grab all that tight, did we, Corbin? But the question quickly becomes, is it the AFL's job to police what clubs do and don't do in their training?
Yeah, absolutely. They're there as the governing body, Ben, to sort of look out for the long-term horizons of the sport. And this is very much a long-term issue. I think the reason why the grab was as long as... Let's pull that down. The grab was as long as what it was is I think Luke Beveridge got there in the end. So I felt for him a little bit because... this was before the information had been handed out to clubs. So I think that's important to point out. By the time the recommendation came back, and this reads off the AFL's website, the AFL has banned sparring and combat between teammates and club staff, but boxing will be allowed to continue if sessions are carefully managed by qualified individuals. It comes after the AFL updated its health and safety protocols for a 12-day absence for any player that sustains a concussion or a head knock.
Yep.
But I don't think there's as much disagreement there between the AFL and Luke Beveridge as that grab makes it sound. So they don't do sparring, Ben. I don't think really you need to. So you can still do boxer size fitness.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any problem with that. But why does there need to be sparring? And I think as we're realising now, one concussion's too many. So if we can eliminate that, then that's a good thing.
Okay. I ask you this then. Is it incongruous that Hawthorn have been cleared, and yet the AFL has brought in these regulations?
Nope, because under the old protocols, Ben, they would have said, look, no one told us we couldn't. So we've been through it, and we don't want to see it again.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you.
Frio's retro jumpers they're going to wear on Sunday night against the Tigers. Flesh it out, throw it out.
I'm fleshing everything out today, but we've got to flesh this out. This is outstanding from Frio. If you haven't seen it, they play against Richmond on the weekend. I'll be broadcasting that game. They played their first ever match against Richmond in 1995. So they're wearing that jumper. It's the white anchor, green at the bottom, purple either side of the anchor, and the red trimmings. It is a tremendous looking jumper. And it got us thinking, Corbin, which are the best retro jumpers in the AFL that you would bring back? Is there one for you?
Just quickly on the Fremantle one, I did like Sports. I think Sportsbet put a tweet out saying there's nothing like a Fremantle to take some attention off their on-field performance than to release a retro jumper to try and take a little bit of the heat off them. That certainly didn't go.
Maybe that they played like
unnoticed.
The Freo of old against Sydney.
I actually think this is a controversial opinion too, Ben. I think the jumpers look better in the old days than what they do nowadays because of the way that they're worn. So the way that they're worn back in the day, they're a little looser and the anchor sits nicely on the middle. So you can see the big anchor and it looks like a unique sporting jumper. Nowadays, the players wear them skin tight and the anchor's kind of stretched. So as a result, it's got this tiny little bit of purple, tiny bit of green, and the white actually takes up an awful lot of the front of the jumper.
So you think they need to redesign it?
That the anchor needs to be smaller, no doubt. So and people have been giving them a lot of feedback saying, oh, it doesn't look like the jumper back in the day, and they actually put them side by side, the jumper, the remake and the original jumper, and they look identical. But the difference is the way that they're actually worn. So back in the day, they were a little looser. Nowadays, they're very tight. And so something just doesn't quite look right visually with the Fremantle anchor on the new skin-tight jumpers. Best jumpers we should bring back. The Eagles had a go at this, and I think they still have an alternate jumper. But the Eagles' yellow jumper,
yep.
I was a big fan of that. I think they actually have that as one of their jumpers. I think we all love the nostalgia around the Brisbane Lions. So whether it's the Lions, which they wear the Fitzroy sort of inspired jumper at times, but also the Brisbane Bears one, Ben, was a great jumper and sort of reminds me a bit of my childhood. So they're the ones that probably come to mind off the top of my head. What about you?
There is a little movement which is growing some sort of momentum that Fremantle need to bring back the giant rock and the anchor on Sunday as well. So I'll be interested. Wow. I know they've still got it. It resides down at Coburn at their training facility, formerly out the back of Fremantle Oval. I'll be interested to see if the Dockers and I mean the literal dockers, like the dock workers, are out there and hoist the anchor up into the air. One thing I would like to say, Corbin, there is a golden rule that needs to be applied to all football jumpers everywhere. Kids should be able to draw them. So the pattern should never be too complicated that it is not straight lines that kids cannot draw and colour them in. If you've got a complicated pattern like the West Coast Eagles, is it Ochre jumper that they had? Horrific. Kids can't draw that. That is the golden rule that needs to be abided by.
Well, kids should become better drawers. This is Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport. We're fast running over time. Any others you desperately wanted to get through here, Ben?
Nah, throw the rest out, Corb.
All right. We'll cover them across the course of the weekend on Grandstand AFL. This is a nice little prelude. We're going to come back and talk about the Olympics next, Ben. But this promo that I'm about to play is particularly relevant for us here on Corbin and Ben.
Luke is an accidental superstar.
I wouldn't have been anywhere near the NBA if I hadn't been 7'2".
An Aussie on the world's greatest team.
We went through trenches. We shared a lot.
I liked his game. I liked his size.
Me and him was able to hit it right off.
Basketball's given me an awful lot, and it's also cost me a fair bit.
Michael rode him a lot.
I wanted to be what they wanted me to be.
You had to show him a little tough love.
Luke Longley reveals all.
I had a change of who I was, and I'm still unlearning it.
Australian Story exclusive, Monday on ABC and streaming on iView.
Three-time NBA champion Luke Longley, the feature of Australian Story over the next 2 weeks. Of course, it got us through lockdown last year, Ben, the first lockdown. We're counting them now in Roman numerals here in Melbourne. But lockdown number one, when we had the last dance. And, of course, the great Chicago Bulls team. So Luke Longley is going to be on Australian Story over the next 2 weeks. He's also going to be our guest here on Monday on Corbin and Ben. So can't wait to catch up with Luke Longley just hours before part one goes to air next Monday night.
Will it be rude to ask him why he didn't return our calls during the last dance, Corbin? We were trying to get him on. I say that jokingly because I think it's great what he's done here, that rather than doing every radio interview request that he received, which would have been innumerable, and I'll ask him about how many, he's done it his own way and he gets to tell his story in his style, which I think will be tremendous when we view it on or in this two-part docuseries on the ABC.
How many times did we try him, Ben, on behalf of our show?
At least three or four.
Yeah, I think that's...
We've also been hitting up Dennis Rodman intermittently since then when we came across his number.
Do you think we'll be able to red paperclip our chat with Luke Longley so we can get Dennis Rodman on the show?
Well, I was thinking maybe we heard Dennis in the promo there say that he and Luke really hit it off.
Scottie Pippen.
Oh, yeah. Was it Scottie Pippen, bugger?
Yeah.
I was thinking if that was D-Rod, maybe we can just say, look, we've got Luke on. Why don't you come on and catch up with your old mate?
This is Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport. The games are ongoing at the moment, and the story which has the whole world talking is Simone Biles. And we're going to catch up now with a woman who has played, almost 20 years as a professional sportswoman, 15-plus in the netball game, winning premierships with the Adelaide Thunderbirds, gold medals twice at the World Cup, once at the Commonwealth Games, and then just switched over to footy and became an All-Australian in the AFLW. She joins us on the couch on Offsiders, and she's with us now, I'm pleased to say, here on Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport, Shani Norder. Shani, appreciate your time.
No worries. Thanks for having me, boys.
Now, Shani, I'd like to say we're going to speak about some very serious topics here, but I do think, with a light-hearted start, that Corbin got you on just to remind us all that he's now on Offsiders as well.
Not the case.
Yeah, we stick together as Offsiders crew.
Correct.
So, we pump each other up and pretend there's no one else that exists.
Correct.
Absolutely. As we said, we do want to have a serious conversation with you. You've been quite candid in the past in speaking about the mental health challenges between professional athletes or for professional athletes in the sporting world. And Simone Biles has really been the story out of the opening 5 or 6 days of the Olympic Games after she pulled out of two different competitions so far, citing ongoing mental health struggles. I guess, firstly, as a conversation which has the whole world talking, what was your reaction when you saw this come through?
For me, I think, it actually was a bit of a surprise. You know, obviously it's not a surprise to see an athlete dealing with mental health because, let's face it, probably 99% of us will at some point in time. But, you know, you just never know when it's going to hit you. And so I really was feeling for her to know that, you know, how hard she would have worked over the last, you know, not only over the last 5 years, but obviously her whole career to get to where she is, but in particular over the last 5 years to work towards this Olympics. And then, you know, to get struck with some mental health issues whilst you're there, it would just be so tough to deal with. And I think especially it sounds like it's really new to her, and from my own previous experiences, you know, and everything's always so different, but you know, when I first started dealing with depression and what I went through, it takes a lot to get your head around, because you're so used to being, you know, the poster girl for your country and so strong at that, because being an athlete, people look up to you and they look at seeing you as being so strong. So for me, you know, I really felt for her, but I was also super proud that, you know, she was strong enough to say, hey, actually, I'm not in my right mind. And obviously what she does is so dangerous. So, you know, if you get one twist or turn wrong at that level, you know, a neck injury, you know, is obviously life-threatening. So I was extremely proud that she had the ability to put her hand up and go, look, I just can't do this.
It reminds me, I mean, it's such a sign of the times, isn't it, as something to happen, that these sort of women feel, not just that there's a lot of sort of negative connotations, since there has been, obviously, with you know, social media, and there's more access to information and people's feedback, perhaps in a way that there hasn't been in the past, but also more empowered than they ever have been as well, to actually feel like they have a decision to make, and that they can take control back of their mental health rather than feeling like they just have to go through with it because they're at a certain point. Do you feel that sense of empowerment, I guess, for the athlete in this scenario in a way that perhaps hasn't been there in the past?
Absolutely. And I think as well, that's also why I was so proud of her, because you know, there was a tweet in particular from Catherine Burns, who was also a former gymnast. And she said, you know, for gymnasts especially, you know, it's all about doing it for the coach. It's about doing it for your country. And, you know, there is the weight of your country on your shoulders. But at the end of the day, you know, your health is still first and foremost. And you are the one that has put in the work and the hours to get yourself to where you are. And so whilst, yes, you want to do it for your country, you still need to be able to put yourself first. And I still believe there's still a lot of athletes, and not just athletes, but just people out there in general that think, oh my God, I'm not well, but I just have to do this, because you put these expectations and external pressures on yourself, especially when everyone's watching you. You know, I'm sure whilst there's a lot of people out there supporting her, there's probably also a lot of negative feedback that she's probably having to read as well, which wouldn't be helping her during this point in time. So I hope that she's got the right people around her and protecting her to get her on the right track. So, yeah, absolutely being able to feel empowered now to take control of your life and your career as you should be able to.
Shani, it's a nice lead into the next question and point that I'm going to make. I felt like there were two really telling quotes from Simone Biles in the wake of all of this. She said, I felt like I was doing it for everyone else rather than myself. And another one yesterday when she tweeted, or today, when she said that she realises with the positive feedback that she is more than just a gymnast. What's your reflections when you hear those two comments? I felt like they were telling.
Yeah, so for me, it's really beautiful. I think, you know, a lot of athletes, they don't realise that until the end of their career. And, you know, she probably is coming more towards, you know, the end of her career. She's been around for a while. And so I think with that, being able to go, actually, no, I'm more than a person, and who I am reflects that, rather than just being the gymnast, which is where the mental health issues generally come from. But also it makes sense why she's having these dilemmas and going through the mental health troubles if she's currently going through, I'm not going to call it an identity crisis, but it actually is when you're an athlete and you realise you are so much more than what you do. And when I realised that, that was when I actually retired from netball, because before that I was all netball, which was why I was so good at it. But once I realised that I had more to life, I actually didn't have the passion to put absolutely everything in my life into it anymore, which meant I wasn't going to be as good as it is. And I'll just touch on quickly what I said before around her, you know, if she was doing gymnastics while not being herself, and that ability to be able to get injured, because as an athlete, you need to be able to not think. You know, like on the netball court, I played my best when I wasn't thinking and I just trusted my training instincts. And so when you can't do that because your mind's working at a million miles an hour and it's starting to think, which is taking away that natural kinesthetic instinct, you know, she knows it in herself that she's not only not going to be able to do well, but as I said, that risk of injury. And so I think it's great that she's been able to stand up for that.
Yeah, it's a really good point you make. I've spoken to my partner who is actually a neuroscientist and deals with people at really high risk and dealing with severe mental health issues, and spoke to her in depth about what Simone Biles is going through. And she spoke about basically essentially that, Sharni, this dissociation that is created and the inability to for the armadillo to function properly and for you to be able to do the things that you have done in your training, which I'm sure I'll speak about a little bit more in a moment. But for those of us who haven't been an elite athlete, you alluded to it there, so following on again, what part of yourself do you have to give up that you pay a price for away from the sport when you are an elite athlete?
Oh, look, that's a really good question. It's a really hard question to answer because when you're young and you're growing up and you're playing sport, you sacrifice parts of yourself that you don't even know that you're sacrificing because it's all you know. And I found that I started netball when I was 5, and I'm sure, you know, Simone would have started gymnastics when she was probably even younger. And so what you're sacrificing is your relationships, your friendships. You don't have generally a close-knit group of friends that you can talk to and download with because you're never there. You're always traveling around. You're living out of a suitcase. Although you probably speak to more people in a day than what most people do, you just have this feeling of loneliness because you don't have that one spot that you get to go home to every night. And then you don't know what else you want to do with your life because, like, and I'm actually, like, having this, not this dilemma at the moment, but for me, you know, I'm 33 years old, and when I was growing up, all I wanted to do was be an athlete. I'm 33 years old, and I've done that. And now I'm like, well, now what? You know, and we're not prepared for what then comes after and then how to deal with that. And so it's like you live in a bubble of, once I do this, this is going to be my everything. But when you realize that, actually, I'm going to finish it, and I'm still quite a young adult, and there's more things to life. And we just don't know what that is. And so it's that absence of knowing, of fulfillment, of drive, of what you're working towards to achieve. Whereas most people in jobs, you know, like you're doing media and you'll continue to do that and grow in your craft. And, you know, and that won't probably end until you decide. Whereas our career ends so early, which is what makes it so different.
So I guess Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka have really started this global conversation, which has been had in sort of certain portions and at different times across different parts of the world. But do you think we'll get to a point, Sharni, where I guess the athletes themselves will be able to come back into the world that it is at the moment and manage it in a better way, but in a different way perhaps than what they were previously? Or do you think that the landscape itself has to change? That there's, you know, things we can do in the press, for example, to make it easier, or the way that these competitions are structured? Is there learnings on both sides you think that can happen here?
Yeah, absolutely there is. I think from an athlete's point of view, it's about being a whole person and realizing that young, which is really hard when that's all that you want to achieve. And I think from the flip side, it's still the organization, whether it be Gymnastics Australia, whether it be Netball Australia, whatever sport it is that you're doing, it's their responsibility to have that psychologist and well-being person in place. But it's also the responsibility to listen to those experts, because I still believe that, yeah, we're getting those people in the jobs so that we look like we're doing the right thing. But I think some of the time, and still maybe most of the time, it's a tick box rather than getting around that person as a human. And I think you look at the athletes that have nailed it. So have a look at a Roger Federer, who's still managing to play tennis really contently and have a really good career at the age of, is he 40 now? That's someone who has his stuff together. Like, he knows who he is as a human, because if he didn't, then he wouldn't still be playing tennis because he'd be trying to figure it out. And so it is about the athlete figuring out who they are outside of their sport so they can continue on afterwards. But in saying that, there's definitely more tough athletes that aren't paid professionally, for sure.
Shani, one of the really interesting things this Olympics has been the athletes who miss out on a medal or miss out on a gold and perhaps win a silver or a bronze, and them apologising not only, I guess, for their performance, but specifically to people who have supported them. What do you think when you see and hear that as a viewer?
Oh, it just breaks my heart because, like, I know, and once again, I've been there where, you know, you train so hard and when you fall short of that hurdle, you feel like you're letting everyone down. But I just want these athletes to know that they've done so well and they've done the best that they can, which is competing in an Olympics. And so I don't want them apologising. You know, they have done everything in their power to get to where they are, and they performed the best that they could on the day. And I think if you know that you didn't do everything in the lead up to get to that place, then you would apologise because you'd be like, oh my God, I didn't do the right training. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. But when you know you've done everything to get to the Olympics and then you've given your all in that last event and fallen short, there's just no need to apologise for it. Like, they should all be so proud. And I really hope that people get around those athletes that do feel that way, because those are the ones that will struggle more so after the Olympics. And Olympians, remember, they're not getting paid. And so when they come back into society, a lot of them just get left. And so I really hope that there's a support network in place, you know, for those to be able to rebound back after the Games.
Now, Shani, one question we often get during the Olympic Games, and I've seen it on Twitter already during Tokyo, how come netball isn't an Olympic sport? And was it something that came up a lot when you were representing the Diamonds where you thought, hey, how come we're not at the Olympics? And was there ever sort of a major push to get it involved in the program?
Yeah, we've always had a major push, but unfortunately there's just not enough countries that play the sport. I think we're a Commonwealth sport. There's about 75 countries that play it, and it's just not enough to get us into the Olympics. But, you know, I was devastated because going to the Olympics was all I ever wanted to do, and I picked a sport that didn't quite go there. But I think it's been a really great opportunity for netball. We missed out on Sydney. There was a really big push for London that we didn't quite make it. But, yeah, I think if we could go to Brisbane in 2032 as an exhibition, but I think the trouble with netball now is they're looking for those shortened versions. And so I think if you're going to see netball at an Olympics, you're probably going to see either and or a mixed version of netball with women and men, and or a fast five version, more like the 3-on-3 basketball.
Wow. That would be eye-catching. There's some unusual sports, aren't there, that have sort of made their way through. Just before we let you go, anything else that's caught your eye through the opening 5 or 6 days of competition where you thought, oh, I was particularly geeking out over that moment?
Oh, I have been geeking out over the equestrian for sure. Those dressage horses are just off there. I'm actually on my way to ride my ex-race horse, and it is a bit of a nag, and I'm going to go out and pretend like I'm riding a So I think I'm just stoked that Tokyo went ahead. You know, there were a lot of us that were like, oh, you know, should it go ahead? Should it not? And it's just been the best thing, you know, especially for Australia right now. We've all been tuning in. We're doing so great. And it's just been the outlet that we've needed in a pretty hard time, I think. So good work, Tokyo.
Well, Andrew Hoy is at his... What's he at? His eighth Olympics. Mm. He's 62 years young. And you mentioned earlier, Shani, you're 33. And I know that you said to us off air before you joined us that, you know, equestrian, you're not going to do it at any sort of high level. But I'm not ruling out a third sport for you yet that potentially we could see you in 30 years' time at an Olympic Games.
Great. If you could just buy me my $1 million horse, we'll be all set.
Shani, appreciate your time. Thanks for jumping on and chatting to us today.
No worries. Thanks, Crew.
Shani Norder with us, Nee Leighton on Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport. An important conversation, and really it's been a fascinating week, hasn't it? I think it's fair to say the Simone Biles story, Ben. The biggest story out of week one of competition.
Yeah, and just before we get stuck into that, I know this is a podcast as well that a lot of people will listen to later on, but Jess Fox has won the gold medal. She's finally got her gold after making a bit of a hash of it in the... K1, she's won it in the canoe slalom, so well done to flying or fabulous Miss Fox winning the gold medal there. Her dad was pretty understated. He said she's a terrific paddler, Corbin, and then he broke down with emotion, according to Twitter, when he described her as a good person. So that was an emotional moment. But Simone Biles and her decision to pull out of competition, at least for the time being, I know you've got a lot to say about it. Where do you stand on it all?
Well, just a little further to that conversation, I think it's important to point out that Simone Biles dealt with Larry Nassar,
yep,
who is the convicted sex offender who was the team doctor of Team USA Gymnastics for 18 years. So there's significant trauma that's attached to that too. So this isn't just your run-of-the-mill case. I hear a lot of people and sort of uncover different things on social media about how it somehow disqualifies her from greatness. Well, she's already the greatest of all time, Ben. Mm. So that's probably something to keep into mind, despite the fact that she has pulled out of her opening couple of events, and it's unlikely that we'll see her much in Tokyo. This was almost a little more icing on the cake, Ben, of what is, you know, already the greatest career ever in the sport of gymnastics. And I think it sort of opens the door a little bit for athletes going forward. We saw Naomi Osaka earlier in the year, and now Simone Biles. And as I touched on there in that chat with Chani, that it's, although there's a lot of negativity with things like social media, and that the athletes have been honest about that in a way that perhaps they haven't been in the past, they don't feel like they have to carry the burden. It's also empowering that it feels like there's another option for them now, that it's not just compete at all cost. It's, look, I need to make sure my mental health is the priority, as it should be for everyone all the time. And then the secondary thing that I do is my profession, which in this case for these people is their sport.
Yeah, I was extremely consistent throughout the whole Naomi Osaka situation, that when she said she wants to play but not do the press conferences, that I said if she doesn't feel like she's up to doing the press conferences, I'm significantly concerned about her mental health, and I hope she takes a break to focus on that, which she eventually did, which was good to see. And I worry about Naomi, Corbin. I know you and I had this discussion, but even when she was lighting the Olympic cauldron, it looked like that moment couldn't be over for her soon enough. There are a couple of really telling quotes, like I spoke to Shani about, that she said, I felt like I was doing it for everyone other than myself, which I think adds a lot of pressure. You can read that inherently in that quote. And then when she said about the support she's received, Simone Biles, it made me realise that I'm more than my accomplishments and a gymnast, which I never truly believed before. I felt like they were really telling. And let's not forget, one of the most interesting things or telling parts of the Simone Biles story that I've read is that she won a world title while passing a kidney stone and couldn't take any kind of medical pain relief due to the drug testing regime while doing that. So this isn't about toughness. This doesn't disqualify her from being tough. Anyone who said that is a ridiculous argument. She got lost mid-air while trying to complete her maneuver, which you're risking serious injury if that's the case. And I spoke to Alex, like I said, who's my partner, who works as a neuroscientist. And she explained to me that when people come under extreme pressure, the theory is that you get dissociation, which is really a protective mechanism that your body undertakes because there is so much pressure on you. And what that means is that there's a disconnection and lack of continuity between thoughts, memories, surroundings, action, and identity. And that would be her theory as to what Simone Biles is going through. It's the stress response of your amygdala, which basically hijacks your decision-making process. So you become incapable of making regular thoughts. So performing the action she would have 100 times over in training before. And that's how we arrive at a situation like we are. And I don't think any of us can really understand or appreciate what Simone Biles is going through in the wake of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we often say when it comes to mental health, Ben, we should treat it like no other injury, that if you had a broken arm or a broken leg, you would go and get medical attention for that the same way you would with a mental health issue. So if it's easier for you to understand, imagine she has a rolled ankle and it inhibits her from competing, and that's essentially why she's had to take a break at what seems like the most inopportune moment. It's not to downplay the seriousness of what she's dealing with. The other point that I'd make, Ben, and I know this has been raised on other shows in the last 24 to 48 hours, Michael Jordan, the greatest athlete of all time, Ben, if his break from basketball, which has sort of retrospectively been referred to as, oh, he wanted to go and play baseball, what he wanted was time out from being the most famous person on earth. And so he was at the absolute peak of what he did. He took time out from that, went and had a break, did something that he loved as a kid, rediscovered his joy, and ultimately came back to basketball. But you can reclassify that as a mental health break. You can call it whatever you want. And maybe if it happened today, we would look at it differently than the way we look at it then.
And Corbin, you know my love for Michael Jordan and the fact that I've read all of the books written by the guys we spoke to here on Corbin and Ben, Sam Smith, Roland Lazenby, et cetera, et cetera. And for anyone who has any real depth of knowledge about that hiatus for Michael Jordan, will understand that it was probably and very realistically a mental health break.
No doubt.
That's what it was.
This is Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport.
Year five, everyone else did their talk, and then I got up with my picture and I said, this is my auntie Juanita. She was murdered by the King's Cross Underground. And then I sat down.
It was 46 years ago.
Sydney journalist Juanita Nielsen disappeared.
Now Kieran McGee has started looking for answers.
There were killers. There were corrupt police. And there were people who wanted Juanita out of the way.
Hear Unravel True Crime, Juanita, on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport, Monday and Thursday from 5 p.m. Eastern, or you can catch up in the podcast store under the Best of Grandstand folder. So we mentioned earlier the Australian story, Ben, two parts, airs on Monday following Luke Longley and his story. But coming to iView this Sunday, August the 1st from 7 a.m., a new docuseries over three parts following four Australian strong women. And the series is called Strong Women, appropriately named, to participate in the strong man sport. If that doesn't make sense to you, it's about to. I'm pleased to say we're joined by one of the four women who will be featured as part of this docuseries on iView. And Lee Holland Keane has been good enough to join us here on Corbin and Ben, ABC Sport. Lee, thanks for your time.
Hi, how are you?
We're very well. Looking forward to the series. I guess I'm going to unpack this piece by piece. First of all, what is the sport of strongman?
So it's a sport that has been around for hundreds of years. I guess, you know, the very start is you can go back to, you know, the fishermen and the kind of Vikings and stuff like that. That, you know, they had these feats of strength that they had to do to kind of, you know, get on the boat and, you know, be part of certain groups. And then it's kind of changed to, you know, there was farmers that were doing kind of, you know, heavy stuff. And then it kind of turned to circus, you know, these kind of feats of crazy strength. And it's a bit more commercialized now. So it's, most people know World's Strongest Men, where they're kind of pulling trucks and lifting big Atlas stones. So, you know, it's kind of changed throughout the years. But it is definitely an interesting sport.
So,
different.
So a couple of questions on this front. One, how does a woman from Queensland end up involved in the sport? And two, how do you end up as part of a documentary series which is coming out?
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a wild journey. So I moved across to Australia in 2003 with my mum and my stepdad. My stepdad was an avid gym goer. So when he came across here, he started training and competing in Australia's Strongest Man. And then my mum kind of followed suit and she started training and competing. She was one of the very, very few female athletes at the time. I think there was about maybe four or five female athletes at the time. So she was a very big pioneer for the sport. So I would go along as a teenager and kind of just, you know, provide support and encouragement, take care of my little brother and sister. 2009, I kind of had a bit of a play around with some of the implements and kind of enjoyed it, and then just jumped straight into competing in 2010. And since then, it's just been, yeah, it's been this crazy journey.
I know this isn't what the sport of strongman is, but to give people who are, let's say, casual gym goers an idea of just how strong you are, Lee, deadlift, squat, what are the numbers that you can push in terms of weight?
So squatted 180 and deadlifted 190.
Well, that's big. That is very, very big. And what does your training regimen look like, you know, day in, day out, week in, week out?
So it all kind of depends on, you know, if I've got a competition planned. So probably about 12 weeks prior to a competition, things really ramp up where it's kind of event-specific stuff. But just in general, and particularly now with COVID, you know, it's more just kind of keeping that base strength. So like you were mentioned before, like deadlifts, squats, overheads, you know, just keeping myself that strength there.
Mm.
How did the docuseries come about and what are we going to see as part of Strong Women?
Oh, look, it's such an amazing documentary and, you know, I feel so proud to be part of this. You know, I was approached by the producers to be one of the main athletes to follow within the series. So, you know, it's been unreal. And the series itself, it doesn't just show our story, but it actually goes through the scientific benefits of the sport and what it does to the mind. And, you know, it goes into the psychology behind it. So there are so much to learn from this documentary, you know, not just following our kind of stories, but yeah, there's so much information that needs to be put out there.
Do you live in a perpetual state of soreness? Because when I do deadlift and squat, I'm sore for about 3 days after. So how does that work?
Do you know, when I take a bit of time off and I come back to it, yes, I do get a fair bit of DOMS. But because I'm continuously training, you know, and I'm on top of my nutrition and stuff, I kind of have that recovery there. So, you know, it does ache sometimes.
So I guess you haven't seen all the three episodes yet, have you? So this will be exciting for you, I'm sure, on Sunday morning to wake up and watch the three-part series. But I guess if there's an overall message or theme to come out of it, what are you hoping that is?
I think just about, you know, joining the sport and building your confidence and, you know, when you look at the stories of four athletes, it shows the up and the down. So it's about just being realistic and, you know, kind of taking out that Instagram, you know, highlight reel and just showing the rawness and the realness of actual real life as a strength athlete. And, you know, I really just want it to kind of show other females that, you know, even when things are tough, you can push through and, you know, you've got a beautiful community that can help you.
Lee Holland-Keane, who's one of the four feature athletes, going to be part of Strong Women, which is released on ABC iView Sunday, August 1, from 7 a.m. So that's 7 a.m. this Sunday morning. You can watch the three-part series on iView. Now that we've got all the official stuff out of the way, Lee, what I really wanted to speak to you about as part of this chat are the Scottish Dinnies Stones. Now, I understand you're only the second woman ever to be able to lift these stones, which are 733 pounds or 332 kilos. And I've done some research on this front. I watched a couple of sort of big burly men and their comments on the stones. And these are a few things that they had to say about them. It felt like 1,000 razor blades digging into my hands all at once. You feel the flesh in my hands tearing. And one man said the hands, it felt like my hands were on fire. Can you explain to us, I guess, firstly, what are the Scottish Dinny stones for people that don't understand? And how on earth did you get them off the ground?
Yeah, so Scottish Dinny Stones, so they're two granite stones full of history. It dates back to Donald Dinny, who was a famous athlete back then. He was just a phenomenal athlete, and he was the first one to kind of lift it and walk with them. So they were named Donald Dinny Stones. So there's a smaller stone, 144 kilos, and a bigger stone, which is incredibly awkward to lift, which is 188 kilos. So you kind of stand side by side with them and you have to lift them. It was definitely a very hard task. The first time that I tried it in 2017, I actually separated my collarbone. So that was interesting. Yeah, that was...
What does that actually mean? Does it broke it? Like it just snapped?
I think it was the cartilage or something, and it took a month to recover from. And it was just, I just felt like this big tear. It was just terrible. But I went back the next year and I lifted them. So it was all worth it.
Surely that was part when you were attempting that for the second time. You must have been thinking somewhere deep down, oh, that better not happen again.
No, I completely zoned out. I had to. I would have been fearful to lift them.
What about this, Lee? There's this thing that, or this story that I've read about weightlifters, that when they lift the heaviest weight, I don't know how to describe it. I think they call it like white noise, that there's this sort of peace that you feel. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely feel when I lifted the dinghy stones, that happened as well. I mean, we were surrounded by so many people, but everything was just quiet for me. I think because you just go into your space and, you know, everybody has their own kind of space that they go to. Some are aggressive, some are peaceful and calm. Yeah, but I don't know. I just feel over the years as well, you kind of, you know, you're able to control that and, you know, really utilize it when you need to.
Just before we let you go, Lee, we're looking forward to the Strong Women series coming out on ABC iView. I've seen plenty of strongman competitions on, I think, ESPN do telecast a lot of the tournaments. What are the sort of branch-off sports? Have you looked at ever doing anything else, whether it is Olympic weightlifting, or do you get into to follow ball sports at all? Or is there sort of any
CrossFit.
Other overlapping interests?
Look, I've always been quite a sporty person, so in general I'm kind of interested in most sports. But I feel like strongman has just really kind of kept me, I guess, hooked. And it's just because there's so many different disciplines, you know, that you consistently have to work on. So there's a constant challenge. And I think that's something, you know, my traits kind of crave. So, yeah, I think I'll stick to this.
I can't wait to watch it. I mean, we do these interviews all the time and you feel like as the sports announcer, you've got to get on there and say, oh, go and check this out. But I'm genuinely going to watch this and fascinated to see what's ahead of us in this three-part series, Strong Women, which comes out ABC iView on Sunday morning from 7 a.m. Lee, really appreciate your time. Thanks for teaching us a little more about it.
No, not a problem. Thanks so much for having me.
Lee Holland-Keane with us, part of the Strong Women series. As I said, released this coming Sunday, August the 1st. You can see it on iView. Looking forward to it, Ben?
Oh, I actually am. I really am. I'll be watching that. What would be your deadlift and squat, Max Corbin?
What? We were going to the gym together at one point. We had the same train. What was our trainer name?
Elliot.
Well, no, what's Elliot? I was about to say, where did we call him by his gym name? But he's. I think I got okay at the squat at one particular point in time.
Yep.
I was able to get pretty heavy. I'm more a road athlete nowadays, as you know, Ben, rather than being in
you're
the gym.
You're an aerobic athlete, not an anaerobic athlete. Let's get into my Olympic either or to round us out.
Don't forget, before we do, Ben, the NRL is on tonight. So, of course, you can hear it here on ABC Radio just after the news at 7. It's the Roosters and the Eels, week 20 of the NRL season.
I've got some good ones for you. I've been thinking these up, cooking them up all week.
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather either win a silver and miss out on gold by a fraction of a second, or just win the bronze?
Oh, good cue. Probably just win the bronze.
Yeah, same. I think I'm the same.
It'll probably feel more joyous than it would be. I can't believe how well Kyle Chalmers handled himself today. Yep. Having missed out by 0.06 of a second. And yet he swam a PB. He should absolutely feel chuffed with himself and the effort that he'd done 7 months after a shoulder reconstruction. And yet I would have been that dirty, Ben, had I missed out by such a small margin.
It would gnaw away at you, wouldn't it? I think I'd rather win the bronze as well. It would feel like, yes, I've got a medal. Okay, the better week at the Olympics is either the pool or the track and field.
The pool. I'm also someone that gets bad Sunday blues. So yeah. I hate the second week in the sense it feels like it's all over. Whereas the pool's also not just it's great because Australia featured prominently and we generally win more than we do on the track. But it's all ahead of you. You feel like you're at the start of the games. Yep. You don't know where to look. Whereas by the time the track comes around, you feel like it's almost over.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's great for us. We win in the pool. Follow up to that. Would you rather win the 100-metre sprint or the 100-metre freestyle?
100-metre sprint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a pretty obvious one. Okay, either or. You were either barracking for Arnie Titmus or Katie Ledecky when they were going head-to-head, Corbin.
It's a trick question. Of course I was barracking for Ariane Titmus.
I'm not so sure about that.
What are you talking about? I'm the biggest Katie Ledecky fan in these parts, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But the achievement for Ariane Titmus, which people can't seem to get through their heads, is even greater because she beat Katie Ledecky. That's part of the narrative. So Ledecky's greatness actually comes into it.
Yeah.
That's
okay,
part of
enough.
The story, is that it's not a good a story if she just beats Jenny Smith from England.
Yep.
It's the idea is she beat the greatest to have ever done it. So don't take away from Katie's greatness. Add to Ariane's.
Would you rather either win an individual gold or a team gold?
Individual gold.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Get
I'm
out of my way. Let me stand up there on the dais by myself.
I think it just means a little bit more. There'd be, I always say team success over individual success. Mm. It's great to share it with a group of contemporaries, but not at the Olympics. More deserving of Olympic sport status, either tennis or golf?
Good question. Oh, tennis, I guess.
Okay. More deserving of being an Olympic event, either skateboarding or surfing?
Skateboarding.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yep. That's it.
Back Monday from 5, Luke Longley is going to join us, plus the voice of Goddard. Enjoy the footy tonight and across the weekend. This is Corbin and Ben.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.